How do you know what's most important to you? Might ask some diagnostic questions to figure that out. You could ask questions like, what do you get most excited about? What leads you to despair when you don't have it? What weighs heaviest on you when you're trying to make plans? What are you willing to sacrifice anything in order to have? Now, you could think about those questions, and you could just put yourself in the most positive light and say, well, really, you know, I just answer God to all of those. And sometimes the answer to what we value most comes out more subtly, you know, and what we spend most time talking about. Or maybe even more so, just how we respond to different things. So take, for example, when a child is born. You would think what you treasure most would come out in how you name your child. And maybe it wouldn't for us, but the people in our story, that's exactly where we see what they valued most. So what's in the name? That's what Juliet asked, right, in Shakespeare's play. And she was trying to argue for why it didn't really matter that Romeo would belong to this family that her family was feuding with. And she's her point, though, despite her argument, her point is that names are just kind of arbitrary. I wouldn't try telling that to the boy named Sue in Johnny Cash's song. I don't think he felt his name was very arbitrary. His dad said they specifically gave it to him so he'd be tough. I hope nobody names their child in those kinds of ways. But names, the names we give our kids are, they often could be significant to us, but they do often still remain kind of arbitrary to the kids themselves. But in Genesis, you read just how important names are. Sometimes God determines a person's name, like with Isaac. Sometimes God changes names, like with Abram and Sarai. But not just God, there are other people in Genesis, and they view the names that they give their kids as very significant, very important. So when Jacob and Esau were born, their names related to their birth. They were significant to them, and Jacob's name kind of takes on a life of its own. But this morning, we're going to see the same thing. We're going to see a lot of names. And they carry a significance that they don't always carry for us in terms of the way that we think about names. They were talking about what was happening to the people at the time that these children were born. And what that means is these names actually tell us what the people were thinking at the time that the child was born. And it reveals what was most important to them. Tells us what they valued, what they treasured most. And as was once true of us, and sometimes is true of us, their most important thing to them was not God. And yet, what you also see is that it didn't stop God from being kind to them. They didn't deserve God's kindness, neither do we, but God was still kind to them. And so we see in Genesis 29, verse 31 to chapter 30 and verse 24. In the middle of all these bursts and this drama that we're going to see, it's very clear that God is determined to show undeserved kindness to these people. And we learn that about ourselves as well, that God's determined to show sinners who don't treasure him the way that we ought to. He's determined to show us kindness. And so we want to think about, on the one hand, this God who shows this undeserved kindness, but then we also want to consider the ways that we too are just as undeserving as the people here in this story. So first of all, what we see is God's kindness or his undeserved kindness to the unloved. And so look at the last part of chapter 29, starting in verse 31. It says, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has looked upon my afflictions, for now my husband will love me. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. Again she conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be attached to me because I have borne him three sons. Therefore, his name is called Levi. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah. And she ceased bearing. So you need to keep in mind what happened just before this. Jacob was tricked into marrying Leah, and then he was allowed to marry Rachel a week later. And that bride price was agreed upon as 7 years for each bride, and he'd already paid for the one. So it then says in verse 30 that he paid for the second marriage. He worked for 7 years. Verse 31, though, isn't then going after that 7 years. It's actually rewinding and telling us what happened during those 7 years. And it wasn't a very pleasant time for Leah. But to understand what Leah is experiencing, we want to understand what the word hated here means. It's not referring to the opposite attitude or emotion from love. It's a different sense of opposite. It doesn't mean that Leah was despised or abhorred. It's the opposite of having love. So hatred here is referring to not being loved. So Jacob didn't care about Leah. He only cared about Rachel. Now God sees everything, but when it says in the Bible that God saw something, it means that he's about ready to take action. He's about ready to address the problem. And very often when he sees something and addresses it, he's seeing oppression. He's seeing mistreatment. And so here he sees poor Leah, whose husband doesn't care about her. And in that circumstance, the Lord chose to show her kindness. He opened her womb. He gave her a child. But he didn't open her sister's womb. Rachel is barren. And in doing so, he gives children to the unloved person, and he withholds children from the loved wife. Leah's response is very clear in verse 32. She gives this name to her firstborn. Now, Jacob is conspicuously passive in all this. He may have picked up passivity from his dad, but he's not involved in any of these namings. And you actually see even other ways that he's passive in this. But Leah picks this name based on its meaning, but it's not that the name itself means what she says. In fact, it's likely that all the names in this chapter were names that they knew about. It's not likely that they coined these names. It's not that likely that they came up with them. They were listening to the different names in society. They're just like us. You know, they had a child and they picked a name. But they picked the name specifically because of what was going on around them. And so Leah chose Reuben specifically because it sounds similar to the word translated looked. The way that sounds in Hebrew. So the first part of the name, the ru part, is probably based on the same verb as the word looked. And the second part sounds familiar to the words affliction and love. So the name for Reuben, it connected with what Leah was experiencing, that she realized that the Lord had seen her affliction. And she was also hopeful that was going to change her circumstance. And so the name also commemorated her desire that this time now her husband is going to love her. Now, we know that didn't work because she has another child. And you could tell from the child's name that nothing had changed. She names the second son Simeon because it sounds like the word translated heard. The Lord saw like he saw in verse 31, here he hears, he heard. And again, that has to do with God taking notice. He's going to take action. And that's what she notices by the second son. God's taken action. He's heard about her situation, about her difficulty, and he's rectifying it now. So for Leah, Simeon represents the fact that God has shown this kindness to her, has provided this child for her. It also, though, points to the fact that she is still hopeful, though she doesn't quite mention it. She's hopeful that this provision is going to help her in her situation, that she is going to have her problem fixed. Again, that's not the case. She has a third son. And it's clear that she's still looking for this affection because she names the child this name, Levi, because of its close sound, its wording that sounds like the word attached in verse 34. But the thing that you notice with the third child is that somebody's been eclipsed at this point. Because prior to that, the two previous names, she's acknowledging God in this, but now all she can see is her desire for her husband to love her. Now, I definitely feel for Leah. And you could feel for Leah. I mean, first of all, she's stuck in a polygamous marriage. And Genesis has been making the case that this is not what God wants. It starts off with Genesis 1, and it's just one wife that God provides. Adam and Eve. And then the first time you see polygamy is with Lamech, the disastrous end to Cain's line. And then you have Abraham's situation where he adds a concubine, and that goes poorly. And the only other instance up to this point is Esau, and he's not a godly person. So all this is pointing to this being very, very negative. And on top of that, on top of the problem of polygamy, she is married to somebody, Leah's married to somebody who doesn't love her. And even worse, he loves somebody else. And she's forced to watch this because he loves his other wife. On top of that, it's her sister. So you can imagine the rivalry there. But it should also be apparent what's most important to Leah. The Lord's attention isn't comforting. She only cares about, really, her husband. So God's unloved by Leah. In comparison, she's concerned mostly with this attention from her husband. And yet, what you see is God still shows her this kindness. Even though she's continually more concerned about rectifying her relationship with her husband, God still shows this kindness to her. He still provides for her in her difficulty. So she's not a pious person. She's not an example of somebody who's doing the right thing. She's an example of somebody who's shown God's grace, even when she's not doing the right thing. Now, she does have a fourth son. And what seems to happen at this point is that her hope wanes. And know that you could read this and think, this is really positive. Because she names a child, I will praise the Lord. But what happens after this demonstrates that she's still not looking to God like she should, even what she ends up naming some later children. So it's initially kind of positive. It is the right response. It's what we should do in response. But, and she's also right to see God as the source. She names Judah because it's similar to the word for praise and probably also similar to the word for the Lord, Yahweh. But as we'll see, it's not as solid, not as positive as it looks at first. So the Lord does cease this kindness here at this point. She's not able to have another child after Judah, but he's not done being kind. So he's kind to the unloved, but we also see God's undeserved kindness to the opportunistic. Look at verse 1 of chapter 30. When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" And he said, "Here's my servant." Then she said, "Here's my servant Bilhah. Go unto her so that she may give birth on my behalf, then even I may have children through her." So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has judged me and has also heard my voice and given me a son." Therefore, she called his name Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and I have prevailed." So she called his name Naphtali. Then Leah saw that she had ceased bearing children. She took her servant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Then Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, "Good fortune has come." So she called his name Gad. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son, and Leah said, "Happy am I, for women have called me happy." So she called his name Asher. So verse 31, it's the Lord that saw what was happening and responded. But here you notice in verse 1, Leah or Rachel saw what was happening and she responded. And then in verse 9, Leah saw and responded. So there's a slight shift here. And you also see a shift in God's name. So God is referred to in the first section as Lord. That's the covenant name for God. It's a more personal name. Here it's just the general term. And you only hear the word God come up when Leah or Rachel are talking. You don't actually see God's actions talked about clearly in this section. So that's a signal from the narrator, from Moses, who's telling the story, that we're about to get into some messy stuff, where the people are not listening to God and following his directions. So in verse 1, you see what Rachel was paying attention to, what she saw. She noticed she wasn't able to have any children. She also noticed that her sister could have children. And so she envied her sister. Now it's interesting when you see this, that both of these women want what the other one has. Leah wants to be loved, and she gets children. Rachel wants to have children. She's loved. Both are not satisfied with what the Lord has provided. So Rachel gets upset with Jacob. She's blaming him as though he's giving children to Leah. And she's using actually the same kind of demanding language that Jacob used when he confronted Laban and said, "Give me my wife." Only she adds an "or else." She says, "Give me children or I shall die." It's dramatic, right? But you can feel her desperation. She really desperately wants to have a child. Now, her exasperated demand does not go over well with Jacob. And he gets angry and he says, the nerve. I have the power to give children. You know, he says, "I'm not the one who grants children. That's God." And then he adds the bitter truth that God is the one who's withheld children from her. And his wording actually reminds us that pregnancy is not an A plus B equals C kind of reality. God has to enable that. But, you know, when Jacob points that out, he's not actually theologically pristine. He's not perfect. Now, yes, he gets the right words down. He understands the truth, but it doesn't change his behavior. He doesn't say, "Look, Rachel, you know, we both know that God is the one who gives children, so we need to pray like my dad did before I was born." He doesn't say that. It's essentially just saying, "What do you want me to do about it? It's not my job." That's all he says. So Rachel, like Rebecca, like Sarah before her, she's not going to sit on her hands. She's got a plan to fix her problem. They had options for having children in their society. It's the same option that Abraham and Sarai had back in chapter 16, surrogacy. So if a wife couldn't have children, she could give her female servant to the husband to be a concubine, and then that the children that would come from the concubine would be considered her children. And that was accepted in their day. It's accepted by their society. It was not accepted by God any more than having multiple wives was accepted by God. So then again, their concern is not what God wants. You can tell that in all this. They're concerned about what they want. So Rachel tells Jacob to take her female servant, Bilhah, to be his concubine. That's a wife with lesser status, lesser rights. And he's to do that so that Bilhah could give birth on behalf of Rachel, so that Rachel could have children through Bilhah. And that was exactly what all the other pagans around them were doing if they couldn't have children. So they do it, they go through the procedure, and it works. You can tell that the child that Bilhah has is Rachel's because Rachel names this child. This child is adopted as Rachel's own child. Ironically, though, Rachel brings God into the situation in a way that is not really appropriate. It's not that God is wanting them to do this, but she picks the name Dan because in her flawed thinking, she believes God has judged her, in this sense, judged in her favor. That's what it would mean. Like other translations, he has vindicated her. And the word Dan is connected to that word translated judged. So it's as though she views her infertility as judgment, potentially. The way that people would look at her, seeing that she's being punished by God, she's saying, "See, God has vindicated me. I'm not punished." And that's why she names him Dan. And then Bilhah has a second son for Rachel. And once again, she actually brings God into this in an inappropriate way. But it's difficult to read. A lot of translations don't translate the word God that way. The ESV reads mighty wrestlings. The Hebrew reads wrestlings of God. And it is hard to translate, but I think it's better to translate the term God in that way, not as an adjective, not mighty. I like how the CSB puts it. They translate it, "In my wrestlings with God, I have wrestled with my sister and won." She's acknowledging that she's trying to wrestle these children from God. She's kind of acknowledging that that's what's happening. But in her succeeding to get this child, she's also succeeded. She's won. She's had victory over her sister, which again points out to something that's very important to her. And even what she said with Dan, it points to the fact that she's very, very concerned about the status, the honor of having children. So she names him Naphtali because it connects with those words, wrestlings and wrestled, and it commemorates her victory over her sister. Leah's not about ready to let the perfect, loved Rachel do something. Anything she does, she can do better. So she does the same thing. She gives her personal female servant to Jacob as a concubine so that they could have children for her. And it works. Leah names the first one good fortune. That seems to be what Gad means, good fortune. And then she names the second one. It works again. She names the second one Asher, which is close to the term for happy. So the first term is pretty devoid of God. It's pretty much a term for random luck that she's experienced. It's positive, but there is no sense that God's a part of what she's talking about. There's no credit given to God. The second term, it's related to the word blessed found in Psalm 1, translated happy here. It's also related to the word that Jesus uses in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers. And it has to do with the idea that this happiness she's referring to is the happiness of having the life that everybody should want, everybody should desire. And so she's confident that other women are going to see her and recognize that she has the kind of life that they want. And that's why she names him Asher. But in all of this, really, God's on the shelf. If you watch what's happening with these women, what they're doing, they've really kicked God to the curb. He's not as important. They're desperately grabbing for whatever they can. And it's not really well thought out. I mean, this plan is born out of Rachel's desperation. She hasn't really thought this through completely. And Leah then just reacts. That's why I refer to it as being an opportunist. She's just doing whatever she can. They're both doing whatever they can to get ahead. And yet, God still shows kindness to these opportunists. I mean, he's not withholding kindness until they deserve it. And yet, he's very deliberate in the kindness that he shows. He gives them these children, even though they've gone about it wrong. And one of the things that I think that helps us see is that these four children that come into this world through poor choices, sinful choices, these four children, though they're thoughtlessly brought about by these humans, are not thoughtlessly brought about by God. But they're actually part of God's plan. God intends there to be 12 tribes. And he's working through their thoughtless actions, their sinful behavior, so that these children, these four children, are no different in the mind of the sovereign God than the other children that make up the 12 tribes. God knew about them just as he knew about the others before their parents decided to go this path. They fit into God's plans the same way, despite the fact that they were born in sinful circumstances. So Jacob and Rachel and Leah, they're responsible for their choices. They're doing the wrong thing, but God is at work even through their sinful choices to produce his good, to bring about these 12 tribes. So even through their sin, it produces good. It produces four children that are loved by God, that are intended by God. It's truly amazing. It's amazing that God shows grace in that way, to show this undeserved kindness that it's very clear from Leah and Rachel's behavior. They don't have things figured out. They're not paying attention to God the way they should. And yet God still shows them kindness. He doesn't wait for people to be perfect before he's kind to them. God's involved in the muck and mire of our lives. He doesn't wait for us to clean ourselves up. He gets involved in our lives. Now, he is sinless in his involvement. And yet, he gets involved even while we're sinners, even while we're sinful. Not standing by with a bottle of spray or Clorox and gloves saying, I'm not going to touch that. He actually jumps in and he's a part of what's happened. So he's kind to the unloved and to the opportunist. And we also see God's undeserved kindness to the misguided. Look at verse 14. In the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please, give me some of your son's mandrakes. And she said to her, is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? Did you take away my son's mandrakes also? Rachel said, then he may lie with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes. When Jacob came from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come into me for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he lay with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. He said, God has given me my wages because I gave my servant to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again, and she bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will honor me because I have borne him six sons. She called his name Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her Dinah. So you got little Reuben, probably was not very old. We're putting this together sequentially. He's just a little child, and he's probably out playing in the field or hanging out with his dad while he's out working in the field. And he comes across this mandrake, which is not the screaming baby plants from J.K. Rowling's imagination. This is a real plant. Though it does have, in their minds, they thought it had some magical properties. They thought it would help with your infertility. So it's just this little broadleaf plant with purple flowers that ends up having this yellow fruit that had a really strong smell. And that may be why it was used as an aphrodisiac. But Leah and Rachel, they're just concerned about it because they think it's going to help their infertility. It's going to help them. Neither of them are having children at this point. Rachel's barren. Leah has ceased to have children after Judah. So both of them want it, but Leah's son found it. So Rachel shows up. She very politely asks for some of them. Leah's response is not so polite. She gives this rhetorical question. She's really just making a statement. And what you can piece together from what she says is that at this point, Rachel is the only one with Jacob at night. Or at least most nights. So Leah kind of gives this protest, and if we put it in a statement form, she's saying, it's not enough that you've stolen my husband. Now you want to take these mandrakes from me, these magical fertility fruit. So Rachel sees an opportunity in what she said, and she makes an offer. She says, all right, I'll make you a deal. Jacob is allowed to be with you tonight if you give me the fertility plant. And notice she actually made a move there. Before she just said some of them, and now she's saying the plant. You can give it to me. All of it. And what's sad is, I mean, this is bartering at its worst. I mean, they're willing to deal in a human being here. Jacob's a commodity on their market. So verse 16 shows that Leah accepted the offer, and she just directly goes up to Jacob and says, all right, you're with me tonight. I hired you with these mandrakes. Obviously, that's not putting Jacob in a good light. But again, you see just how passive Jacob is. He's just, all right, just does what he's told. Doesn't have any spine, it seems like. And once again, God heard Leah's situation. It doesn't mean that Leah was actively praying, though. What it means is that God hears. He has heard her tearful nights. He's heard what she's been going through. He always hears, but when it mentions that he hears, it's because he's going to take action, and he does. He provides a fifth son. And it's interesting how Leah interprets this. Again, they're not interpreting things correctly, so we don't just take what they say as, well, this is the way things really are. This is the way they see things. She views this birth as wages, as a reward for her giving her servant to Jacob. That's not what it is. But it also commemorates her hiring Jacob. Same terminology for wages and for hired. They're all related to this name, Issachar. So he commemorates the night that his mom hired his dad with some mandrakes. And then Leah has a sixth son, and she names him Zebulun, which sounds similar to both endowed or endowment and the word honor. So she's here, just like with Issachar. Zebulun is acknowledging, rightfully, that this is from God. God has brought this about. But it also focuses in on what Leah is most concerned about. It's focused in on her attention from her husband. So just think about, what were those mandrakes for? Why were they valuable? And you could see that Leah thought they were valuable. She recognized their value in the way that she responded to Rachel. What were they for? They were supposed to, in their thinking, they were supposed to help them get pregnant. They believed that this kind of magical fruit was going to help them with their infertility. And yet God gives two sons to Leah when she's given them away. And she doesn't give any to Rachel, who now has them. Why would God do that? God's still showing kindness. He wants to show kindness in this situation, but he's also very deliberate about what he's doing. They're not acknowledging God rightly. They think that they have more control than they do. They're misguided. So God's very careful about how he shows that kindness. But even though they're misguided, he still shows kindness. He doesn't show it to Rachel because she's trying to manipulate things through this magical way. But he does show kindness to Leah. He doesn't hold it against her that she was planning on doing the same thing. We cannot let her off because she used these things to get her way. She's thinking in the same way, and yet God still shows her kindness. She's misguided. And you could tell that in the way that she names her children. She's misunderstanding. She does not realize the way things really are. And that is when God takes initiative with us. He is not showing us kindness because we figured it out. When God is kind to us, when he initiates this relationship with us, it's not because, oh, well, we're starting to learn, we're starting to figure it out, we're starting to connect the dots. No, actually, it's his kindness that is helping us bring us around to see the truth of the word, opening our hearts to see that truth. It'd be easy for us to think that we're special when we look around at other people. We look around at the misguided people who don't believe in Jesus. We could look down on them and say, you know, that's poor saps, you know, I just don't get it. We get it. We're the enlightened ones. The reality is, we're only different by God's grace. We are no better than anyone outside of these walls who doesn't attend church. We're not better than them. We should look at the people around us like we look in a mirror. Say, but by the grace of God, this is my life. And to realize that we could be the instruments that God uses to straighten out that life. Because he's going to straighten out that life the same way he straightened our lives out with the gospel. And he can use us to share that with us. So we should not look down on those people who do not trust in Jesus yet. There is one last note here in this section, verse 21. It mentions Leah giving birth to a daughter, Dinah, and she doesn't get an explanation for why they named her because she's not one of the 12 tribes. And it also is worded in such a way that she may not have even been born at this point. She could have been born later. But it's mentioned here because they're introducing her for chapter 34. It still highlights God's grace. Still highlights God's kindness to Leah, who before had been kind of cut off from Jacob. Now she's had two sons and a daughter. So God is kind to the unloved, to the opportunistic, and to the misguided. And lastly, we see God's undeserved kindness to the ashamed. Look at verses 22 through 24. " Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She called his name Joseph, saying, may the Lord add to me another son. Now, if you go back to Genesis chapter 8 and verse 1, in the middle of the great flood, you have these words, God remembered Noah. It wasn't that God forgot about Noah, like he started doing something else and said, oh, there's a guy floating on the top of that flood. Now, he knew about Noah. When it says he remembered Noah, it means that he's focusing in on what he had planned for Noah. And that's what it means here when it talks about Rachel. God is focusing in on what he planned for Rachel. He'd heard about her situation too. He had been listening the whole time. He had heard her crying probably night after night because she felt the weight of not having children. She did get the adopted children, and she was very, very excited about that, but there was still this shame that she felt, not being able to have children. God wasn't ignoring her. His plan for her required him to wait. But now he's ready to act, and it's at just the right time. And so like with Leah in chapter 39 and verse, or chapter 29, verse 31, he opened her womb. He shows her kindness. Not at the same time as Leah. Not in the same way as Leah. And in fact, God is free to show his undeserved kindness to anyone he wants, whenever he wants, for his purposes. And understand what God's purposes are here. He has planned to bring about these 12 tribes. That's what he's doing, even as he shows kindness to these women. So Rachel had a son, and she rejoiced in the fact that God has taken away this shame of being unable to bear a child. In the ancient world, women found great significance in being able to have children. And it really is a very, very special role. Only women are able to do this. It is a privilege. It is truly significant. A significant role that God gave only to women. That he equipped only them with this amazing ability. I mean, it's a miracle what he does through them. So women really should see bearing children as hugely significant, massively significant, and yet in our modern society, we have tried to hide the significance of this to such a point that not only are women willing to sacrifice children for the sake of things like careers, they're even willing to boast about it, which is what recently happened. One woman at the Golden Globes, where she referred to the murder of her child in utero, euphemistically, as simply her choice. There is wonderful significance in being able to bear children. That's a gift of God. We should see that amazing significance, something that is so much more significant than any career any man or woman could do. We should see it with that same significance. Now, the problem is the ancient world, it was so important that women felt ashamed if they wouldn't be able to do that. And that's not right either. They shouldn't feel ashamed. No woman should ever feel ashamed if she's unable to have children. It's not something that's on her. That's the kind of shame that comes when we have the wrong perspective on ourselves. When we believe that our only significance is in something that we can accomplish, something that we can do, some success that we can have, whether it's pregnancy or some other success. That's not where we get our significance from. Our significance comes from the fact that we're created in God's image for his purposes, and that's where we find true and lasting significance. But God isn't waiting for Rachel to get things figured out right. You know, he's going to show her kindness. And again, he freely chooses to do that, even though she's wrongly ashamed, wrongly thinking, wrongly considering herself insignificant because of that. God shows her kindness. But notice, even after God shows that kindness, this amazing kindness to Rachel, it's not enough. You can tell by what she named her son. Now, the name, it sounds similar to the word for taken away, so it's commemorating the fact that God's removed her reproach, her shame. But It's more close to the word add in verse 24. Her name is essentially a prayer. She names the son that God graciously gave her basically a prayer that God would give her another son. She's not satisfied with the son that God gave her immediately by his own name. Now, the truth is neither of these women are satisfied with God's kindness. God has shown kindness to Leah. And we, again, I point out that the situation's probably a little improved for Leah because she had been cut off from Jacob and she's able to have not just that one son, but another son and a daughter. So it seems like there's been a little bit of a resolution there. But she's not satisfied with all that God's given. And Rachel, too. She has a son and immediately is praying, I want another one. What these women are guilty of is idolatry. Listen to Ian Duguid. He explains, he says, this is the essence of idolatry. Someone or something other than the living God is occupying the God-shaped space at the core of our being. We were created as worshiping beings, people whose meaning and purpose cannot be derived from ourselves, but must come from outside us. There is always someone or something to which we look for our whole identity and self-worth. If we turn our backs on the true God, we inevitably attempt to fill that void with something else. Whatever we must have instead of or as well as the God of the Bible, if life is to have meaning for us, that is our idol. And idols don't have to be inherently bad. Children aren't bad. Love from your husband, that's not bad. But an idol is anything that displaces God. Because God should be most important. And that's where all our dissatisfaction comes from. Worshiping something else as though it was God when it's nothing close. We were designed to worship God, to enjoy life with him. And that is where the satisfaction really can come. The sense of fulfillment can really come from that relationship. And so whenever we are searching for happiness, for satisfaction with something outside of God's design, outside of his intentions for us to be that fulfillment, we're always going to have that feeling that something's missing. Maybe we'll ignore it for a little while, but there'll be something that's missing. Again, listen to Ian Duguid. He says, it may be the desire for good health, a better relationship, excellent grades, a new job, or any one of 1,000 legitimate or illegitimate things. Whatever it is, when you ascribe ultimate significance to it and say, I have to have this or my life is empty, it is an idol. So it's easy to feel bad for Leah. She's unloved. It's easy to feel bad for Rachel. She's ashamed. But the reality is they could have found satisfaction even in those circumstances. And Asaph summarizes it in Psalm 73. He says, whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Asaph is despairing in that psalm, and that's his resolution. That's where he comes to as a conclusion. And when that's true, then the attitude you can have in any circumstance is described by Habakkuk when he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. And we could add, and my spouse doesn't love me, or I'm unable to have children, though I'm not being promoted at work, and my bank account is empty, though no one really notices me, and I haven't got any friends. Yet, says Habakkuk, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. You say, I can't do that. I don't know how to do that. Well, understand that that kind of thinking really is based on, and it's only found for us in this other child who was also born to a woman, who, just like Leah, upon finding out about her pregnancy, said, from now on, all generations will call me blessed. And this son was also given a very, very important name that pointed to the fact that he would save his people from their sins. And it's this son who demonstrates the ultimate expression of God's undeserved kindness. Kindness of God sending his very own son to rescue us from our own idolatrous hearts. We've turned from finding our joy and satisfaction in God to finding it elsewhere. And it's that reason, or that's the reason why Jesus came, why God sent his son. We've been wandering away from God. We've been making a mess of the world. We've been misguided and opportunistic, unloving and unloved, shameful and ashamed. But the thing that the Bible is very clear on is that God didn't wait for us to change. God instead shows this undeserved kindness in sending his son to become human, to live the life that we should live, to live and then die and pay the punishment we deserve. And why Jesus did that was to bring us back to God. It was not to allow you to live whatever life you want now for whatever enjoyment you think and then get out of hell so you can have a nice afterlife. That's not why Jesus came and lived and died. He died to bring us back to God so that we could actually enjoy that abundant life that he intends for us. Life of satisfaction, the life of fulfillment. Died and rose again so that we could have that loving, joyful fellowship with God. That's what we're actually longing for. That's what's missing. And even if you can't recognize it, that's what you need. So what I would say is, I would say stop chasing after idols that are not going to satisfy. I think this next one, no, this next one's going to do it for me. It's going to make me happy. That's not what you were meant for. Stop chasing those idols. Turn to Jesus and trust yourself to him. Trust in what he did to rescue us from that empty chase. And if you are following Jesus, then when you're tempted by these other things, these temporary things, these other idols, when you're tempted to say, I think I really need this, you need to turn back to Jesus. Turn back. Turn away from that that's not going to provide you with that satisfaction. And you can do it. If you're following Jesus, you can do it because you have the power of his Spirit in you. And you can then turn back to that undeserved kindness found in him. Join me in prayer. Father, it's so easy for us. So easy for us to lose sight of you. So highly distractible. And yet you show this consistent love, this faithful love to us. Father, thank you. Thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for this amazing grace towards us. Help us to see it. Father, open our eyes to how wonderful it is that we would recognize your love. That it would impact our lives. That we would stop chasing after other things and realize what we have in Jesus. Make that real to us, Father, by your Spirit. And Father, for those that do not know you, that are in a death march, chasing after things that will not satisfy, I pray that you would rescue them from it. That you would open their eyes to that empty chase. And that they would turn to Jesus. They would experience life to the full. Because they now love you. Find what we were always meant to experience. It's through Jesus that we ask it. Amen.